I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu Marcus, and I'm back with Mind Rolling and an old new friend who I dearly appreciate for the kind of work that she's been doing over these last many, many years in the tech sector. And you have heard her before on Mind Rolling. I'm laughing because I couldn't remember that I did this show with her before. So you know Danielle has the Google Empathy Lab, which he runs at Google, which is the oxymoron of the century, empathy in Google. And they, I'm sorry about that, Mr.
Yeah, Google Empathy Lab and the most forgettably unforgettable guest on Mind Rolling ever.
Oh, so untrue. Anyway, welcome, Ananda.
Thank you, love. Happy to be here. Always a treat to ramble and wander with you, my friend.
Yeah, absolutely. So before, we were just bantering before, and I was showing Danielle this book, Cynicism and Magic, from Trogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, which she already had a copy, and I was expressing how important I thought this book was and inspiring. So I happened to, I thought, wow, this is kind of the premise for us all. In anything we're doing in our, first premise is you realize there is a path to transform yourself out of the identity roles that Ram Dass talked about in the perspective of egomaniac, narcissist, which we all are to one degree or another. And Trungpa is the great cutter below the knees. He just cuts off the bullshit. He really does. And so I said to Ananda, you know what? I kind of just want to read some of this because, and just talk about it because it is so extraordinary. So do you mind, Ananda?
Please, take us off on the Trungpa magic carpet, my friend. Also, cynicism and magic coming from
what the hell
one,
is that?
One of my worlds being technology, the others obviously being the spaces of spirituality and mysticism and natural wisdom and all these things. It's like cynicism and magic feels like such the both the struggle and the elixir of this time. So
actually, and I thought the same. he translates these two words in ways which you would never have thought. Well, first of all, cynicism, he's talking about, it's really emanates from the Buddha. You must trust your experience. So you need to be, as he, this word cynicism, he's not using in a negative sense like we would. Like, I love cynicism. Boy, I watch Larry David all day long, right? He's not talking about it like that. He's talking about it as being able or taking the perspective of not just jumping into anything without direct experience, which is, and his biggest thing, of course, is around meditation and the depth at which one needs to go and the discipline one needs to have. So then magic. And so I did this thing with my friend David, and it's a podcast is not even out. I think I did it with David. Oh, God, am I getting it? Magic. Well, we never really got to magic. And I was looking at this while we were waiting to go on. So I just want to, just so everybody gets the idea of really who he is and how much he's contributed to the spiritual pantheon of greatest translators of arcane information, really. So here it is, magic, which is the last chapter in his book. As students and teachers, we can cut down the fortress of spiritual materialism through how we work with situations. We don't combat spiritual materialism through warfare, street fighting, or sending bombs in the mail, but by developing intelligence within ourselves. How about the contrast of bombs in the mail, street fighting, and warfare? Well, let's not do that. Let's develop intelligence with ourselves. Within ourselves. Then we can work with spiritual materialism. And by the way, spiritual materialism bypasses the current word that is somewhat akin to spiritual material. We use everything on the path that is coming to us and then we're moving into as a way to transform and putting our ego in the same place it was before we ever knew anything about this stuff. And it is about as useful as it was before. It's the same. So we can work with spiritual materialism so that our tactics can be transmuted and transformed into a project that is not spiritually materialistic, a project of worth. We must not become militant or dogmatic about our practice. The basic notions of egolessness and of pain, suffering, dukkha, help us understand that it is not a doctrine we are trying to study. Rather, it's an experience we are working on in ourselves. We are already involved in spiritual materialism to a certain degree, but we can transmute, transform, and surpass such materialism. That's what we're trying to do. The most important point about magic is that it cannot happen in the realm of spiritual materialism. Magic can only take place when you begin to transcend your potential for egomania. It can only take place when there's no ground and no security. According to the Buddha, the highest magic, real definite magic, can only develop from a non-theistic approach. The world is filled with magical energy. We, on the other hand, are filled with unmagical properties. We do not understand who or what we are, and we think there's something to understand which makes us unmagical. We think everything has to be manual and dependent on pure karmic depth, as though you have to get in a bread line, and if you're at the end of the line, then the bread supply runs out and you're rejected. Too bad for you. Somehow in the realm of magic, things don't work that way. In the magical realm, there's an enormous abundance of energy in constant supply. It just keeps going. If you approach magic at a non-materialistic level, it is at your disposal. You can relate with such magic directly, constantly. You can transcend karmic consequences because they don't make any difference to you. Magic is available to you and you can work with it. Have you ever heard anything like that in any spiritual text, really, aside from, you know, magic of, you know, lesser powers and using magic and Aleister Crowley and all that stuff?
You know what? I don't think I've ever heard, like, a reference to the Buddha talking about magic. And I think what's interesting is it almost sounds like what I heard in so much of the language there. And the key to him is always his language. Like, I love that you go from kind of like fortress all the way down to egolessness and unmagical and magical properties. But what I'm hearing is it's like the physics of the non-dual universe versus the physics of the dualistic universe, or the physics of the materialistic and the manual and the mechanistic versus when you kind of let go of those levers and then other things are possible. It's fascinating just to hear someone describe these invisible and tangible spaces that we work with, whether it's in the creative process of our daily lives or whether it's just inside of ourselves trying to sort out the mess of me versus the movie of me.
How would you maybe translate some of what he's saying, particularly what was he saying here? In the magical realm, there's an enormous abundance of energy and constant supply. And how would you relate that with some of the work that you are involved with, which is certainly to help transmute energy, period, with people who are activating some of the things that are going to be as ubiquitous as dining room tables in the future, right? So with that abundance, that knowing that that energy is there, and if especially coming from obviously, shall we say, to make it simple, and some of these terms is oversimplifying, but non-ego place. And there's no way you don't have an ego, but non-attachment ego place. How do you feel like that applies to some of the work and getting others who are the deep influencers and producers of the kind of technology that is, as I say, going to be ubiquitous in the future? How do you bring them into a realization of magic?
I don't know about the realization of magic, but I feel like there's what you were talking about with the abundance of energy. And even just as you were reading his words, it reminded me of actually a Caro, a Peruvian practice, and they talk about working upstream in the energy. So if you stand in a river, like it's kind of it's a ritual, and where if you come upon a flowing stream or a river or some body of water that's moving, the way that they understand their present, the way that we understand our present and future, if like in the Western kind of North American space, if we were to stand in a river, we would say, well, the things in front of us are our future because it's where we're going. And then the things behind us are our past. And it's actually a reverse for the Caro. And so when they stand in a riverbed, in the flow of life is what this practice is. It's to what's in front of you, because it's what you can already see, is actually your past. And the future is what's behind you as it flows from the mystery through into what's visible and tangible. So I love this kind of portal practice of working with movement and a moving element, because what you do is you stand with your back to the current of the river and you kind of surrender to letting it flow through you. And I feel like that visceral experience, that kind of simple moment of feeling the planetary wisdom kind of coming through you and letting go into your spot in all of that, it is lovely, because what it does is it says that is the abundance of energy that's coming through. We're just the pipe. We're just the conduit. How do we align ourselves with, how do we kind of get, like, I love that saying, it's like, more wood behind fewer arrows. It's like, how do you align yourself in such a way where that momentum tunnel of the inevitability of the collective kind of comes through you? And so when we think about, okay, well, how do we take kind of esoteric or mystic ideas like these and incorporate it into the work? I mean, Empathy Lab's real kind of the gisty statement of it is, it's how are we taking our deep human and planetary wisdom and applying it to new models of intelligence and emerging technologies? And we work on everything from kind of AI, which is the most mysterious of all the new technologies, and super crunchy hardware, things. And that's kind of like, what are the physical things, the atoms, that enable these like magical bits to kind of do what they do. And for me, it goes back to what, Baba Ram Dass and what he gathered from Meher Baba with that it's heart to heart to heart. I feel like the best work you can do in the space isn't necessarily to come up with some really brilliant, complicated vision of how to render the new technology, like Ray Kurzweil meets, Gandhi or whatever. It's actually not the big, big, big things. It's the little, little, little things, because it's in the interstices of this technology that our beliefs, our values, our hearts can kind of breathe. So the way that we work with that is really, and that kind of upstream concept I was talking about with the Caro is, they say, if you're in the riverbed and there are boulders to move, you can get your whole family and the whole village together to try to move the boulder, which we all know, whether it's personal work or effort in the world, it's like, that just don't work. And then what you can do is take the journey, the courageous journey, upward, or sort of northern in the territory, which is go as far upstream as you can. And when you do that, if you find the right place at the source, you wiggle your fingers in the river there. And then that builds the momentum as it works with the flow of the river to where it will move the boulder itself on the kind of behalf of all there. And I think it's like these systems of entrainment. How are we working with the grain of ourselves? How are we working with the grain of wisdom? How are we working with, it's kind of what I was saying about what you read. It's like there's a non-material physics and there's a material physics. And we look at questioning in kind of a true inquiry way, what are the materials that we're building with, seen and unseen, tangible, intangible bits, atoms, and how are they like kind of strung like an arrow to the sun, where they're working towards the thing that we kind of really want, rather than just, there's a lot of kind of technology for its own sake, a lot of invention because it's possible. Yeah. And we're just in a different space where there's enough mystery inherent in these technologies where it's the personal work. It's almost like using that boulder thing. How do you remove the stones from your own river as beings in the room making things? And how, by removing the friction or the stumbling blocks or the obstacles to love and connection inside of ourselves, how can then that prepare us to be in the room in a different way where we can do the same thing for the technology?
Yeah. Does the boulder maybe an AI developer? Is that possible?
Tell me more. Product designer Raghu Marcus.
No, I mean, when you say, there's no way you can purposefully move a boulder, of course, without some really fancy equipment that you can't fly into the Grand Canyon.
Another robot helper.
Yeah, right. But something happens with, you mentioned the abundance of energy, and it comes through you and just naturally moves that boulder, right? So to me, it's an analogy for people who maybe don't want to step out of their known habitat in terms of inner knowledge, in terms of even thinking, wow, yeah, there could be something else that I don't know about. It's not all about atoms, and so it is all about atoms, but it's not about the way I relate to them. that there's some openness there that, wow, let me see what else happens when I interact with physical universe. And but I don't know, is there a lot of developers that in your experience that think like that? Is there? Or is it more of the bolder and maybe you've got to become more of the energy is just being released off of you naturally and affecting someone by virtue of your own connectiveness with magic?
I feel like, I mean, we're humans, right? So everybody's got boulders and everybody's got pebbles in their shoe. And what I find is that, I think we talked about this a little bit last time. It's like, whether you're speaking the language of the social sciences or the chemical sciences or, you know, astronomy sciences, or, you know, it's like, whether you're speaking the languages of science or you're speaking the languages of deep humanity, or you're speaking the languages of nature, or you're speaking the language of spirituality, really, those are just our, you know, those are our channels. There are different tongues all leading to the same place. So what I find is, like, the first, for me, in terms of like just working with the material of this non-magical and magical space, because they coexist, it's like dark matter and matter, right? Mm. And so I feel like it's just what
maybe
are you
not, by the way, maybe not. I don't want to quickly agree there on something that when Trump talks about magic and his, he never actually defines it particularly as any one thing. So to me, it's yes. Beyond magic, non-magic. It's beyond that scope of polarity, basically.
Yeah, well, I think if I were to get crunchy on it, I would probably say that magic would be the gravitational force amongst the magic and the non-magic. It's the interstitial, mm-hmm. that kind of liminal
presence.
The
gap. Yeah.
That,
the opening.
That thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I had to be if I tried to be a scientist of inquiry in Trungpa's lab, that would be my guess. But
that's a good idea.
That's
Naropa
the new lab.
Should have, yes.
That's the new lab.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to the man who's the president and runs it in a couple of days. I'll mention it to him.
Yes. Now I completely forgot what the question was.
No,
we focus so much on the nothingness. The somethingness evades me.
Yeah. No, it's just, my curiosity around, because you are working and have worked over many years with developers, particularly, and the first thing you said to me when we met in Maui was, yeah, what I do is, my purpose is to inform the developers of our, shall we say, good human instincts around love, compassion, kindness, and how that can be instilled into the algorithms that become an AI or whatever. And I'm still wondering how to get these people to understand the, first of all, the extraordinary importance of it for our future. I mean, you read Elon Musk is like, this is going to kill us. AI is going to kill it, you know, whatever he thought. How does one introduce these concepts to somebody who may be a little bit of a heavier boulder, shall we say? How do we introduce that in order to and not make them run the other way and make it available in a spacious manner to consider at least curiosity to look at.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, a couple of things. The first is we both know, and we know from all the teachers we have in common, it's like you can't make somebody get open. Open up, you know, you can't do it. It's like, that's not the job. The job is just to be a really welcoming presence and warm presence and a kind of safe space for people to, for me, so much of the work isn't how do I get you to understand this? It's actually just, how do I make a container where we can use the language of science to point to the things that science hasn't touched yet, that ancient wisdom has, that we know in our own hearts we can feel. Mm-hmm. And so kind of to that trunk of point on direct experience, it's like, how do you just create the set and setting for someone to look into themselves and to look into things in a way that isn't what the normal kind of whiteboard, office, desk, you know, computer conversation would allow. So there's no element of force. I mean, believe me, I tried that in the beginning. I would like just talk till I was blue in the face about all these things. And that was just a long time ago. It was like, oh, this doesn't work. Or people are like, well, that's lovely, but it's not theirs. It's just you and yours. And then that's not very helpful. Yeah. But I feel like the other thing is it's having a conversation. Like I kind of mentioned this a minute ago. It's like, have a conversation in someone's mother tongue. So, you know, in learning from Ram Dass and Franco Stasevsky and Roshi Joan and other people in the kind of conscious dying space, it's like, actually the be a loving ear, be a loving rock, be refuge. Mm. Like all of that translates. Or I look at like Bernie Glassman and the Zen peacemaker. And it's like the goal is to hold all of the polarity and to find the harmony within that. So I feel like we have these lessons from all of these great beings where it's like, oh, okay, well, if the goal is to listen first so that I can gather the language and understand the direct experience of that person. This is where the emotional intelligence work comes in. You don't know someone unless you know their story. So knowing someone's story, knowing the why in the room rather than just the how or the what, it's like enables me to actually kind of sidle up energetically to where they are. And then when you're sharing a perspective, it's like, when you're coming at it from where they are, that kind of deeper empathy and resonance actually allows, you know, you to be sort of sitting next to each other, so to speak. And so you can look out at the vast horizon, or you can say, look at that dark cloud. That freaks me out. Does that freak you out? How do we work with that? You know, it's just the first person to get vulnerable in a room where the container is safe is where, you know, I look at all of the conversations that are happening right now around, like, I heard this incredible interview with Jason Reynolds the other day, Krista Tippett, our friend, and Jason Reynolds talking about anti-racism. And what he said that was so beautiful, because she said, what's your definition of this? It continues to be such a provocative and incendiary topic. And it changes, the fire changes with every passing month or event that happens. And so he said, you know what, for me, anti-racism is just that muscle inside of us that says, it's the muscle that says we are humans together and I am human. And what that means to me is that there is more of you that's like me than is not. And I think it's like, you just look at these challenging topics that are uncomfortable, where it's like, I look at like a place like Google, or I look at all these big places or little places where it's like, well, this is how we need to talk about this now. And this is the language and here's the protocol. And what's funny is that's almost some of that unmagicality, where the truth is the uncomfortable spaces of talking about what is to come when we cannot see it, when we're more in the mist than we are under the spotlight. Mm. You know, when we're not looking for the keys out in the street, we're under the street light, when we're actually trying to find them in the place with no light. It's like just the ability to create some trust and point to the right thing in a room like that, and to say, hey, look, I don't know either. It's like then the awkward conversation, the uncomfortable conversation, the painful conversations have a frame versus the, I know, here's where I think we should go. I have the solution. I have these letters behind my name. So much of the environments I work in are kind of taking off that armor, that professional armor, that academic armor, that I'm the one who knows, I'm the expert armor, yeah. And just saying at a human level, what is going on here? Or, wow, we never thought this would happen. Or look at that experiment that's happening. What do we think about that? Or, you know what? Oop, this, we don't like where this went. Okay, that's done. You know, it's the courage to look at things as they are.
Yeah. You know, the loving rock thing, which is, as you said, came from Ram Dass's experience with working with dying people, to be able to be in a room and not be the rock part, not succumb to one's own polarized stuff around death and, of course, fear, and being there for the person, being open and allowing that person to express themselves however they want and loving that. Boy, it's as you were saying it, as you were speaking to it, I was thinking, yeah, we could use a little of that in our national political dialogue and our tribal warfare that's going on right now. Very, very, very difficult because it's so incendiary and we have so many belief systems around from one side to the other. And very tough, but I think that maybe, we should start pushing that out. Loving rock needs to happen here to transform some of these crazy, crazy polarizations that are going on, well, all the way to the vax thing, right? How about the...
There's always new material to bring us together, you know, that we think is actually a shearing force that brings us apart. The invitation is, oh, this looks like separation. Yeah. How do we look beyond that? I think what's really cool, too, about the idea of the loving rock and, and viva la the loving rock. It's like...
Viva loving rock. It's an Elvis movie.
Yeah. But what I was going to say, though, is it can look... I think one of the real challenges of my work too isn't the technology. It's what are the many forms and flavors of integration? Because like so many of the conversations I have with people, like we had Mirabai and Ramesh the other week talking about being Ram Dass, and what was so rad was, you know, we had people asking questions, and some people are asking questions about the path and about, you know, I feel like my kind of working self feels really far away from my spiritual path sometimes. And sometimes they feel closer. And how do you do this? And social action. And it was this really beautiful conversation where people got to just drop all the veils and be like, here's entirely who I am. Even if it's with this smaller set of people, which was still many hundreds of people, but it was like lovely for people to just drop it and say, this is the rub for me. How does this work for you? And by everyone saying, oh my God, me too, me too, me too. Mm. It was like, oh, well, integration, like, it's kind of like the little monk in the big city or leaving the cave. And that's why Mingyur Rinpoche is amazing. He snuck out and went to live in the world. You know, it's like, what are the forms of loving rock? It doesn't have to dress in the clothes we immediately recognize. And so one of my favorite examples of a loving rock and a curious person creating, you know, new containers for conversation is this guy, Dylan Maron. He gave a TED talk a few years ago, but his podcast or his like YouTube series was literally conversations with people that don't like me. And what he found is he would do these things and people would tear him down and say all these nasty things. And he would call him on the phone and they would talk. And they would always get to the place where there was more connected than wasn't. And I just love, I'm like, Dylan wouldn't call that sadhana, but I don't care. That is beautiful dharmic work.
That is, absolutely is. And the other thing you talked about, we are all human and we all have the same aspirations and we have to, that's finding that complete common ground. So that meditation that we do at the retreat in Maui, Mirabai does just like me, is exactly that. It's like His Holiness saying, we all want to be happy. We all want love. We all want community and so on. And so that's a good exercise as well.
I do that at conferences. I spoke at a couple AI conferences. Yeah. And it's actually what's lovely is it's like, you do this spirituality and science sandwich where it's like, I'll talk about some really hardcore stuff and I'll be like, okay, come with me on the bridge. People are like, well, I believe that. And I believe that. And that scientifically sounds accurate. And okay. And I know that author. And then you play the Baba video where it's like people drop from their rational minds to their intuitive heart. And then you travel a little more in kind of the science and integration. And just like me is where I often end, because your heart dissolves into that oceanic space of connection and you can't not do it. Like I've actually had people write me, especially because so many conferences right now are virtual, people write me and say, I did it with you. And it's this lovely thing where I'm like, again, to the magic, it's like, there are the unseen forces that we can rely on to hold us. And I'm convinced that like that person knew they were looking at me and I hope they were getting it from me. But then also I'm like, I don't even know how that showed up in my life that day or that morning. And some, when I got a shitty email or when, you know, something happens and you're challenged, it's like, who knows where the invisible support, or like you were saying, this abundance of energy, to quote Joseph Goldsmith, the infinite supply arises.
Mm. So here's another little thing from Trungpa. When you say to somebody, gee, it's so nice to be here in your house, what you experience is magic. Now he's defining magic. You feel profoundly good. You feel something real, some relationship taking place. You are sharing one half of reality and somebody else is providing the other half of reality, so it begins to feel definite. That's our whole experience in India, Ananda. Mm. Really, I mean, I read this and I just think of how we were taken into people's houses and immediately felt completely embraced and warm, like going into a hot tub and just letting go. And from their side, it was the biggest joy in the world that they could provide that. And the union of that is magic. And that magic actually is pretty much what we've represented all these years, certainly when Ram Dass was in Maui, and we continue without him being in that body. And that sense of the give and take, we are so happy to be here and we are so happy that you're here. That's just so terrific. I really love that.
Yeah. I remember that feeling so viscerally and clearly. It's like the spaceship that builds, the like the arc of the retreat experience is just, yeah, it's the transcendence that everybody's in the spaceship.
Yeah, exactly. So Trungpa goes on, though. I mean, this is in the moment, everybody. I actually didn't read this chapter when I did this podcast because I couldn't get to it. And I'm so happy because this is phenomenal material. What we are doing here, and this is talking about the sharing of one half of reality, is being there and feeling profoundly good, and the other one is providing the other half. So he says, what we are doing here is a performance of magic. Performance of magic and a miracle. It's not that somebody has been zapped, has gone into a state of hysteria or a trance and has suddenly become a Buddha or has turned into a lizard. Where does he think these things? We are talking about much more than that. Somebody happens to have turned into a true human being. This is all I care about. This is so great. This is who we are. Before, we had doubts about whether we were human beings or not. We had enormous doubts. We did not know who we were. And now, everybody has turned into a human being, which is the greatest magic of all.
You know what's so beautiful about that is, like, following the feeling of that, it's like, and, you know, it reminds me of Baba's teachings with Emmanuel too. Like, why are you trying to get out of this human thing? Like, take the curriculum.
Yeah.
It's like, what's cool is like the real magic isn't to move beyond human being. It's to be a true human being. That's so juicy. Turned into it makes me think of like, it's like the spiritual Velveteen Rabbit being loved into becoming real.
You know what? We should do, this is all going a little bit inside everybody out there, only meaning that Ananda and I have been talking about putting on a retreat in 2022 through the foundation, Love, Serve, Remember, and around science and spirituality, the intersection of that. We are not going to call it that, everybody. Okay. How to be a true human being would be a better title. And I'm just thinking, you know, I'm just thinking this conceptually to address that to sort of both sides of the equation and make that the prominent rudder, shall we say, throughout what it is that we're trying to share might be a great idea.
Well, I think this illusory dichotomy thing of magic, non-magic, real, not real, material, immaterial. It's like we're pointing to the seen and unseen forces that animate our lives and that animate the nature and the very nature and being of incarnation. So yeah, the idea of turning into true human being, their true human being, kind of science and love. It's like, I think, again, it's like the idea of how do you, it's like, love and emptiness too. I remember that from one of my first retreats, being so moved by that discussion, because it was like in the vast embrace, there's everything and nothing, and that you can participate in your trajectory towards one or the other, or really what is both, in whatever way feels easiest to you. I remember Sharon saying that. I love that. And I think like in terms of the truth, science is meant to be the revealing of truth. And of course, the nature of truth changes depending on our instruments. But when we look at technology as instruments of seeking, that's where seeking unconditional love, seeking the truth, it's like same, love everyone, tell the truth. Same thing if you have the right lens in the scientific space. And I think that's where the more expansive your heart and mind are together, the more you're actually open to the possibilities that unfold themselves. And, you know, circling back to AI, it's like, I remember having a learning curve there where in the beginning I was like, I was not great at math and this is very hard for me to understand. And conceptually, I get it. And I'm going to use all of my human frames to understand it and all of my scientific frames to understand it. But what was funny is I talked to my boss, who's one of those like planetary brain genius people. He's a computational neuroscientist and just a renaissance being. He's incredibly lovely.
He's still there, by the way, your boss?
Still there. He's still my generous benefactor, but truly he's a partner in expansion. His name's Blaise Aguirre Yarkas. He's worked with creativity and
wait, that was machines. Too fast. If we want to give him, honor him a little bit.
Yeah. Blaise Aguirre Yarkas. And I remember saying to him, well, what happens when this happens? And well, how do you train the machine to do this? And how do you refine the data set in such a way where it is unbiased and diverse and what was so cool is he was like, these are the things we do know. And these are all the things that we don't. And what I loved is it was like the sign of the greatest intelligence in people that are designing things for the future are the ones who say, this is the part that is the vast mystery. And they're not afraid of it. They embrace it. And so say we all in the contemplative space.
Is that fairly common in the people that you've been working with? Embracing the mystery is a big word. It's not nothing.
I don't think that they would use that kind of contemplative poetic language. They would more say, I don't know. And I think, you know, the idea of like, I don't know mind, you know, beginner mind.
That's good.
That's probably a little closer. The poetic kind of mystical human heart part is just, it's what keeps me going. But everybody's on their spectrum.
Yes. Yeah. Let's just emptiness, which is as soon as that comes up, that's a toughie, big time. Okay, because there is a big association with that term, even within Buddhist philosophy, of nihilism, not-ness. Yeah. And Robert Thurman, who has been with us on different retreats, is close to us, has the most beautiful definition of it, the womb of bliss. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is not nihilism. Mm-hmm. And certainly to inhabit that space is to follow Trungpa Rinpoche's instructions about magic here and cynicism and magic. I always want to make that note, especially because it's easy to fall into something that's just absolutely does not represent that Buddhist term. We talked about there's magic and non-magic, you know, all the polarizations that we've been talking about. So here I found his definition. We are not talking about black and white. Mm. We're talking about total magic, which transcends black and white magic. Black magic's trying to destroy your enemy and create constant chaos. And white magic is trying to create lots of wealth and power. Black magic is for destruction and white magic is for prosperity. We are not talking about magic at that level. That kind of magic is like a children's story, which reminds me of how people were talking about different saints in India when we were with Neem Karoli Baba Maharaji, and they would, these great miracles that they could perform. I mean, the powers, cities that they had, you know, and they were telling Maharaji, he said, yeah, you know, they used to have, like, ages ago, they'd have sadhus who'd come and do magic contests. It was fun. It was like, completely, this is not what it's about, which is what he's saying. That kind of magic is like a children's story, and we go for that, especially in the West, because we've never experienced anything like this stuff. And what we are talking about, Trungpa says, is a fundamental, all-pervasive magical quality. It does not belong to the logic of good or bad, but to the totality of existence. Therefore, magic is always available to us. You don't have to counteract somebody's powerful magical ability with your own. It is self-existing. Mm-hmm. Right on, huh? One of the most difficult things is we talk about this stuff. We realize there is a path. And then we have to step on it and move, like in walking meditation, slowly, one foot in front of the other, completely consciously, with full mindfulness. And Trungpa takes it further in terms of meditation. I don't know what this, there was. He has a beautiful thing about meditation. I don't know if I could find it, but basically, it's not about, what does he say? Surfing. Yeah, I went and did my meditation today. I was surfing. He said, this is not anything to do whatsoever with meditation. He's very fierce about the sitting, being able to sit with oneself and get into at least one pointedness through insight meditation, basically, that Joseph and Sharon and Jack brought back. And then being able to really get self-aware, but it's through definitive discipline. I mean, he's very fierce about that. He was that with everybody, even though, you know, on his the external of it all with him, I mean, we used to sit there and he'd drink sake, giving a talk. It was so clear and precise. Yeah. But then he'd even if he was slurring, it was clear and precise. This is not someone to basically follow in that way, because this being, in my mind, had transcended a lot of duality. I mean, I wouldn't really know with him, but the clarity with which he spoke about the practice of meditation was absolutely, without question, something that's difficult for us in the West. That kind of discipline.
Very uncomfortable. Yeah. We love comfort. We love shiny. We love things that make things more interesting. We want the entertainment form of all these things. Yeah. And it's kind of why I love his ferociousness, is it's like to put the hot blade through our consciousness, you need the rigor, you need the blade. And it's like I'm a huge fan of the poetic and the blooming and the lovely and the gentle practices and all of that. But the truth is my real work comes in when you're really struggling with yourself, or when you're struggling with something that's challenging. It's that like hot blade of discernment for me that helps me cut through what is the slippery ego-ness. I love him as a representation of all of that, is because the slippery dance of what looks to be ego is what his performance is. And then the blade of consciousness is right through the center of that. So you just can't escape it. It's so disarming.
Yeah. I did find the thing he said about meditation when somebody asked, well, how does meditation differ from introspection plus breathing? You know, and I think I'm a pretty mindful person who's got a lot of introspection going on. And, you know, and he said, well, that's not meditation. Meditation simply means you should sit in a particular fashion, straighten your back, do nothing, work with your breath, and follow the discipline. It's very simple. We're not talking about meditation as a casual handling of reality. So we could glide in midair. We're talking about meditation in terms of serious work, actually putting in our effort and time and energy and doing it wholeheartedly, properly, precisely. You sit on your cushion and you do it. You may be tempted to listen to music and sit, or sit sunbathing on your front lawn, thinking it's meditation, or go to Acapulco and swim or skydive. These things are not regarded as meditation. We have so many problems and complications, so we need to simplify things. The sitting practice of meditation is the only way to get your head together, as they say, or your foot together. Whatever. You have to sit and actually do it. You have to follow this particular technique and discipline. There's no other way. You can't philosophize, Isla. This doesn't mean that the rest of life is anti-meditation. You can work with meditation in action once you have the experience and discipline, and you can handle long stretches of sitting. But I would recommend not experimenting with any other things before you have developed this discipline. So he's very, you know, and our little, you know, where we come from, where we were, Maharaji didn't tell us to do anything or teach us anything. You know, my famous thing, well, how do I meditate, Maharaji? And he said, well, meditate like Christ. When he was nailed to the cross, he felt no pain, only love. You know, beyond anything I could ever think that I could accomplish in any lifetime.
Yourself in love like Christ.
And we all ended up doing, you know, Southern Buddhist practice of Vipassana meditation. And he was like, you going to the course? He'd say in English, course. Mm. And off we'd go and come back, like, you know, and I've told this story a million times. I came back once from the course and he said, well, now you know how to meditate? I said, yeah. If there was three or four of us and we went, he said, well, do it. And so we all sat up straight and like a iron rod in our back, and we did it. And he's sitting around with a bunch of other Indians, and as soon as within 5 or 10 seconds, there was this high pealing laughter. Look, they know how to meditate. So that's the level of obviously where we're at. You know, I mean, Krishnadas tells these stories also of not being a big meditator, although it's not quite true, because I do know that he has used his practice and sits with the Tibetan teachers all the time. We are not great meditators, those of us that come from this bhakti tradition. I mean, there are some serious ones like Danny Goleman, you know, and Danny, who's been so close to His Holiness and to the Tibetan teachings, and many others of us, including Lama Suryadas, who's did 2-3-year meditation retreats. So I would just say to everybody when they hear this stuff and go, yeah, there's no way. I mean, because the guy who started out the question that he answered, it was a QA, I find meditation very boring and irritating. So I think there's a lot of people of us out there that do find that or, you know, are in this, in that. I personally have gotten through it because I don't pay attention to myself as much as I used to. And it's more like that. And I just do it because I do want to know myself way better. I do want to be able to get to a point where I actually can be in Neem Karoli Baba's heart space and connect in that way. So I have the motivation. And motivation is a big thing, too. So
what I find interesting about the meditation stuff, and I love that we're talking about this because it's refreshing to just be able to be like, I'm terrible at this. Is there? I went to a meditation retreat. It was a smaller one. There were about like 20 people there, and it was really lovely, wonderful teacher. And what was funny was everyone went around in the beginning in the introduction circle and was like, "I'm this person. I've been meditating for 4,000 years. I work with these teachers. These are my practices." And by the time it got to me, I was like, I've been pretending to meditate for 25 years. I don't even know if I'm even close to the idea of the glimpse of the, I'm like, I've been sucking at meditation for 25 years. And then I have other practices that I try, but I don't know what it is I'm doing. You know, I mean, like you do, you follow the teacher and everything else, but it's a funny thing to say, like, I am this. I'm like, I pretending at feels so much more accurate to me. And I think what's beautiful though, is I pretend often enough that I hope that in the kind of, especially, and what's so beautiful about kind of Ram Dass and Friends or the circle that is, you know, part of this satsang, it's a satsang and a sangha. It's just, we all need to be here together, doing this work. But it's lovely that it includes so many different doorways or facets of seeing all of this, because I feel like my practice pretending at meditating actually equips me to, when I sit down and do loving awareness meditation, my heart feels different. So this is where that's that space of magic. I don't know what's going on in there, but I know something is afoot, and that's where I just put my faith in that. And yeah, I keep showing up because I need to practice. I need the practice, even if it's just pretending.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the big thing Maharaji said to one of our mentors, KC Tiwari, at one time, KC went, he was just walking somewhere and he said, you know, this is all bullshit. However, he said that. They used to, of course, Maharaji did speak in that language quite a bit, using language. But Casey, this is bullshit. Practice what? You know, repeating mantras, nothing happens. It's ridiculous, something like that, right? And Maharaji said, you are absolutely 100% right. But you keep doing it, and then that one time that it becomes real.
Mm-hmm.
One time. So you keep doing it. So as you just said, I'm fake meditating for a long time, but then you had the one time through loving kindness meditation, loving awareness meditation, and that's really what it is. And you got to be highly motivated to, as Trungpa says, get real with it. That's why I love him. He's just so, am I going to be the guy that's going to, I mean, I have sat real retreats, meditation retreats, and sat for a long time, you know, I'm all about, actually, and the more I think about it, because we're going to be getting together and the board of the Love Server Member Foundation, what are we doing in the future? And that's, you know, all that kind of stuff that boards do. And I'm thinking, okay, what's the one thing that I would want to be part of going into the future? Community, providing that as much as we can above anything. That's the way I feel about it. And, the kind of sustenance that people get from satsang, the way in which, you know, we do these retreats and Mirabai can do her just like me thing where, you know, you turn to the whoever it is right next to you and do this exercise of different questions of just basically we find out we're just like me. And then the greatest example of that, just like me, was we were in India with Ram Dass. I don't know if I ever told you this, Ananda. And we were doing a retreat. Maharaji sent us all up into the Himalayas to do a meditation retreat. And that was a whole other crazy thing that happened. And so we ended up in this Gandhi ashram, actually, which was, you know, where he had written one of his books. It looked right up, right across from the whole horizon of 26, 7, 8,000 foot Himalayas, right? It was extraordinary. And so we all had a room, and Ram Dass had a room, and he said to do this exercise. You'd sit right in front of him, eyeball to eyeball, and you'd go. He would say, whatever it is that you're afraid to speak, say it now. So everyone would, all this garbage would come out. But the people next door and down, because it was India, there's no insulation or anything. They heard everything. So we all got to know. We all had the same, talk about just like me. You know, it's all around sexual bullshit, basically. That's what people are the most afraid of, right? For the most part. So, yeah, the way in which we understand that with each other is a great both starting point, midpoint, and end point.
Yeah.
Being able to do that. So, like we're doing it right now.
Well, and speaking about the, I think what's interesting, I don't think I put this together too, but hearing Trungpa speaking to or effing the ineffable magic and being able to put things to it, it makes me realize that saying, you know, I think it was Thich Nhat Hanh, but I've every time I say who I think it is, it ends up being someone else. So I have no idea who said it, but somebody said that the next Buddha will come in the form of a Sangha. And then there's that great, you know, kind of actually my namesake, Ananda, you know, saying to the Buddha, Buddha isn't friendship and community, half of the path. Says, no, Ananda, you're wrong. It's the whole path. And part of me thinks there's that, or when, you know, when two or more gather, it's like there's a reason that there are so many different sayings of this one thing, which is when you get together, I'm convinced that's where you, then the magic knows to creep in. It knows to reveal itself.
Beyond whatever bullshit that you're living in that moment, it's this the most powerful thing. And then that drives you to want to engage that within yourself more and more and more. And that's where meditation or chanting, you know, real practices that convert.
I love that you just said that, because, you know, I hadn't actually turned, it's like as above, so below, as outside or as inside, so outside. But when I think about the inner sangha or satsang, we think of all of the selves inside of us, all the shadow, all the light, all the history, all the lineage, all the hope for the future. You know, it's like there are so many voices inside of us too. And so cultivating the cohesion and integration of the inner satsang is actually a beautiful way of looking at that work.
Yeah. Yeah. You could say, hey, come on guys, let's all get together.
Yeah.
Okay. We can.
One at a time.
Yeah. It's all good. We're human. It's okay. You know, a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're at the end of our sponsors' allotted time for this show, like we're on CBS.
Ran out of timelessness.
Yeah. And thanks for being here, Ananda. And we hope to see more of you, even though we might have forgotten the last time we saw you. I told Ananda, okay, I'm doing too many podcasts at this point. but I love them, and I love hanging out with you and everybody. This is Mind Rolling on BeHereNowNetwork.com. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com, and tremendous opportunity to hear a bunch of different messages and podcasts from teachers and thought leaders. And, you know, we're encouraging Ananda to think about maybe joining us in that way, because there's speaking to the future in terms of what is so rapidly happening around, particularly, of course, AI, is an extremely important topic. Everything that's been going on with these social media companies. See, we could go on about the blockchain too. You know, that's a whole other thing where metaverse, that now they're Meta is now Facebook, but then the metaverse through the blockchain and all of that's pretty interesting too. That'll be our next thing.
We need two T's in there, not one. Metaverse,
yeah, right.
With two
exactly.
T's.
Exactly, yeah. Oh, boy. Thank you again. And everybody, we'll see you next week on Mind Rolling.
Thank you. Ram, ram, love, love.